You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Right, finally on the show today, we're going to take a look at John Key's legacy, or, as political blogger Giovanni Tiso wrote, the man who does not have a legacy. Tiso says Key simply continued on the work of Helen Clark as a moderate centrist prime minister who did not undertake any major reforms. He says he was only good at winning elections, was very personable, hence his popularity, and that the country has been on autopilot throughout his 8 years in power. Well, earlier I spoke to Giovanni Tiso about Key's legacy, and I began by asking him what he means when he said John Key is a leader without a legacy.
The meaning of the title is pretty self-explanatory. I don't think that I really put the question of about what John Key's legacy actually is, and I kind of answered the question by saying that he doesn't have much of one, other than being a conservator of Helen Clark's work, which in turn was kind of after a period of reform was a government where very radical reforms that had happened in New Zealand were sort of bedded in, and things were kind of frozen. And he continued at work, and I think he did it very astutely because he thought that this was going to guarantee that he will stay in power, and he's been incredibly successful at that. So there are two sides to the argument. One is that, yes, I may look at it and say, what did you actually achieve as a prime minister other than being a prime minister for a fairly long time? The other side of it is he was very successful at doing one of the important things that a politician needs to do, which is secure consensus.
You say the only thing he was good at was winning elections. Could you explain what you meant by this?
Well, it's a provocative statement. You can take politics as being one or two things, as being the art of enacting policies that are your actual objective. You know, what you want to do is actually put certain policies in place. The other objective is to win elections so that you can do that. And the two things are a bit chicken and egg, in the sense that if you can't win elections, you're not going to enact your policies, and if there's no point in having policies if you can't secure the secure support for them. I think in this case, it was really the securing of the consensus, that part, the securing of the support was really a strong suit, and it was incredibly good at it. I mean, we really are going to look back on those results, 44, 47 and 47, and go, how did he do that? Because in New Zealanders are used to those kind of numbers because we used to have a first-past-the-post system. If you look around the world in countries that have a proportional system, like the German one, which is very similar to the New Zealand one, it is incredibly difficult to get those numbers. Mm-hmm. Helen Clark didn't manage to get those numbers at all. Again, we're not used to it because we don't have as many parties perhaps as other countries, but we do have a few now. And so that's actually one of the challenges for the people who are going to follow on from him is going to be National doesn't have really natural coalition partners who have more than one MP or two MPs. And so it's going to be really difficult for them not to govern unless they get that kind of level of support. He was excellent at doing that. And again, it's faint praise, if you like, because that's only part of the job of a politician.
Do you think it was his personal appeal more than anything, which is why he was so popular?
The personal appeal wouldn't have meant much if he hadn't been a moderate, if he hadn't run a moderate line. My suspicion is that this is not his natural political instinct or what his ideology and his beliefs are. I think naturally he's much more radical than he has been as a prime minister. And you can sort of tell that if you read the first speeches that he gave as an MP when he first came in, and he was already being groomed. You know, his intention was to become, you know, he had been handpicked because he wanted to become prime minister. He wasn't going to be just a minister or just a, certainly not just a backbencher. He had abandoned a pretty high-paying job because he wanted to aim eventually for the top spot in National. And his first speeches are quite radical. He talked at one point about women on the DPB who are, and this is the quote, you know, for want of a better word, breeding for a business. You know, you make children to make money. That is the kind of language that he completely eliminated from his vocabulary as soon as he became leader of National. So I think he made a very clear choice. He wasn't going to be Don Brash, but he also wasn't going to be the early John Key. He was going to be someone who, you know, he recognized how successful Helen Clark had been at securing a sort of a middle class, at really kind of creating a big center in New Zealand politics. And he was going to become the leader of that, become the natural choice for those people. But in order to do that, he had to be a centrist by New Zealand standards, We are in some ways a fairly radical country, but he was going to run it just to the right of Clark, and completely in doing that, took the options out of Labour's range, and they had no response.
What do you make of the idea that Key was the face behind the brains of the operation that was Bill English?
I don't know. I mean, English himself was a bit of a funny leader, wasn't he? I mean, he tried, essentially, Bill English had tried to do the Orewa speech before Brash, but sort of did it in a kind of in a half-hearted way, and it didn't, you know, it was really, you know, he tried to be racially divisive and anti-Maori and didn't succeed at that. I don't know that he has too much political substance, to be honest.
Right.
He was a terrible leader. So I think it's a bit ungenerous of towards Key to say that he was just the face of Bill English's master plan. I think that Key was really in charge, and he was the one who was going to be securing the support the National needed to govern. And then he put him, you know, some of his, of course, because the National Party is a big party, some of his MPs were conservative and some were more centrist. He had someone like Judith Collins, who he wisely put on the front bench, but who certainly has very different views to his. And Bill English was just one of the people. But the fact that he chose it, I suppose the fact that he chose him as his deputy is also an indication that he wasn't going to be too radical.
He was also very good at playing the media and brushing off criticism. Has there been anyone as good as this, do you think?
No, but again, the criticism wasn't... I mean, how he survived dirty politics, I'll never know, to be honest. He was exceptional during those 6 weeks or 8 weeks. Really, we have to take our heads off to him because that was great. I mean, if you remember the interview he gave with Gavin Espino, when Espino was pushing him on whether what Collins had done was okay, and he kept saying, is it okay, Prime Minister? And he just refused to respond. That was one of the few occasions in which he was really tested, because he ran a really tight ship. And on Christchurch, they had certainly, I think, on the reconstruction of Christchurch, we haven't heard as many stories of not the early stages of the reconstruction, but what's going on now and how effective, competent, or otherwise the reconstruction has been. So on one hand, I would say the media hasn't necessarily criticized him enough on some issues of substance. But whenever he's been tested, he's always been really good.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you hear him, you know, yesterday morning, he really impressed me. Yesterday morning, he went on Morning Report to defend Ann Tolley, and surely had already, by that stage, decided that he was going to resign. But here he was defending Ann Tolley against Kim Hill for 10 minutes on the morning when he was going to abandon the post. That's someone with a pretty good work ethic, if nothing else. And he was really good. That was really his element. He was really good at it. He was personable. It was calm, really difficult to ruffle him, so he just did his thing.
So just finally, how do you think political historians will remember him?
That's the tricky part. I don't think they're going to remember him. You know, if there are achievements, and I was really quite impressed. I mean, you can take my piece as coming from a political, from a sort of predictable political place, but if you look at what the Herald published yesterday, they rushed an article out to talk about his achievements. And there was nothing there. There really was nothing there. You know, they had to. There was really four really short paragraphs, including the fact that he had been a Balmoral. The Balmoral, you know, it's just, you know, there was really very little there. Someone suggested to me yesterday, as a response to the article, said, "Oh no, this is nonsense." For instance, you know, GST reform. And I don't know. Do you even know what GST reform was? I don't know. He raised it, but someone else said he had started a conversation on the flag, which I think is a really amusing way of putting the fact that he completely botched that referendum. So I don't know that there's going to be a lot said other than the fact that possibly he was a stable hand in a decade where other countries in the world operated quite differently. But again, that's fairly faint praise for a conservative leader.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.